MLive reviewer John Serba reports that Elton John, 2 days before his 69th birthday, put on a strong show last night at Van Andel Arena in Grand Rapids. Quote, intently musical, the work of seasoned performers. Elton John is fit as ever on the keys. This was a nearly 2.5 hour show with a lot of hits, but some deep tracks as well. 3 new songs. Can't help but recall Elton John's memorable appearance at MSU's Jennison Fieldhouse, May of 1972. He opened with Tiny Dancer and had everybody in the palm of his hand the rest of the evening. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. The Detroit Public Schools are one step closer to a financial rescue after the state Senate voted on Tuesday to approve a $720 million plan to restructure the troubled district. At the center of the legislation is a plan to split the district into 2 distinct entities. The old DPS would exist to pay down hundreds of millions of dollars in debt, while the new district would focus on students' education. I talked to 2 of the women keeping a close eye on Detroit's changing educational landscape about what these changes would mean for public education in the city. Sarah Reckow is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University who studies urban education policy. Tanya Allen is the CEO of the Skillman Foundation, as well as the director of the Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children. Tanya Allen says without the crippling debt, DPS will have the chance to reimagine itself, but she cautions that legislation won't solve all of the district's problems.
So it doesn't fix education in Detroit. It really does now require Detroiters to figure out how we're going to solve and fix the education conundrums in our community. The second thing that it does, it returns control back to an elected school board, which really will allow Detroiters to have a voice in public education. So right now in the city of Detroit, there are 3 different entities or controllers of education, and there are no local control or democratic process in that. So the EAA is an appointed board. Most of the authorizers who determine where schools open and close in our city are appointments predominantly by the governor. The other thing that is in this package of bills is a Detroit Education Commission, which really looks at the entire ecosystem of schools in Detroit. It's the whole marketplace. So we want to look at how schools who are in the EAA, schools in DPS, and schools in charter schools who are opening and closing in Detroit, all of them without any coordination, how we create some local control and coordination to that.
The Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children, of which you were a key part, released a report about a year ago that charted a path forward for DPS. How well do you think the Senate package meets the goals you laid out in that report?
Well, I think it meets some of the basic goals around making sure that the EAA is transitioned out, that we really build a stronger state function around that. It deals with the debt. It deals with local control. It deals with the DEC. We also asked for a few other things, which included, you know, how we engage families at the local level, really making sure that there are people engaged in the decision-making process. It's not there. And then there were a ton of academic reforms that we recommended that just did not get the kind of attention as the power and the money, power and control get. Those kinds of things did not get picked up in this legislation. And we're not necessarily sure that it should have been picked up in the legislation. These are the things that I think Detroiters must own and design and execute.
Sarah Reckow, I'll turn to you. The Senate package now moves to the House, but it cannot be taken up legally until next week, which is when the legislature is scheduled to take a 2-week spring break. Now, last week, the House passed a bill that would give DPS $50 million just to keep the district open through the end of the school year, but it did not take on any of the bills dealing with the long-term plans for the district. What do you think will be the political sticking points between the bills the Senate has passed and what representatives in the House want to see?
Well, it does seem that the Detroit Education Commission is a key political sticking point and has been for quite some time.
Governance.
Yes, the governance, absolutely. And it was proposed by Governor Snyder. It was part of the Coalition for Future of Detroit School Children plan. And it has been, I mean, even as the Senate bill passed, it's the, you know, been singled out for critique, especially by charter school advocates. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're going to be fighting that as, you know, the House considers this.
One of the interesting things about what's going on in the legislature right now is that you have Senator Jeff Hansen and other outstate legislators outside of Detroit working on and supporting this bill. Is there similar support in the general public outstate? What do Michiganders who aren't living in Detroit think about the plans to save DPS from bankruptcy?
So we just saw results released through the State of the State survey through the IPSR here at Michigan State, which show that there really is support for a financial rescue plan for Detroit. And it extends beyond Detroit, and it actually extends across the political spectrum. So the overall support is 66% of Michiganders support financial rescue for Detroit. But you see it among Democrats, among independents, among Republicans. In fact, it's a plurality of support, 49 in support versus 40% opposed. So in effect, I mean, I think these legislators are responding to where Michiganders are. And it's not, you know, it's not isolated to one part of the state.
Tanya, as we mentioned earlier, probably the biggest change in the Senate package is splitting DPS into two entities, one that exists solely to pay down debt while the other deals with the business of actually educating kids. So if this passes the House as well, what would it mean on the ground and in classrooms?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that it's going to matter is that it will mean that the debt of the district is not on the backs of school children. And it also will allow the district to rectify some of the expense challenges which create inefficiency. So there is definitely a DPS tax on every contract they have because they are not timely in their payments, et cetera. And then you also have the challenges with your teachers. So teachers have not had raises, quite honestly, since 1999. Their salaries have decreased, as well as they have a tip payment that they where they basically loan the district $9,000 to $10,000, and the district is still holding that money. So you have a pretty disgruntled and disrespected teaching force that's at the district. And I raise that in particular because this isn't about money for teachers. It's about making sure that teachers are deeply engaged, that they're deeply invested, and they feel committed to a district because the district is committed to them. And that when you have teachers who are engaged and focused on children, then you're going to have a better outcome. And so I think that the finances will take away a ton of stressors that really are impacting the district in lots of negative ways.
Sarah, another player in Detroit public education, which isn't getting quite as much attention right now, is the Education Achievement Authority. That's the state-led district running 15 of Detroit's most troubled schools, and it was the subject of an op-ed last Sunday by you in the Detroit Free Press. Eastern Michigan University, which partnered with the state and the DPS to create the EAA, voted in February to sever ties with the district. In your op-ed, you seem to suggest the turnaround district was doomed from the start. Do you still feel that way? And why, if so?
I do argue that there were some decisions made early on in its design and governance that was not particularly transparent, not particularly responsive to Detroiters and to the families in the schools. It was an appointed board. It was primarily accountable to the governor. And additionally, you know, the initial plan for these schools was a fairly kind of top-down reform plan to implement this personalized learning strategy, relying on a great deal of technology to implement it going forward with a fairly new teaching staff, kind of from the get-go, from the first year that they were operating all of these schools. It was extremely ambitious, and it was very unproven when they began, and they had a very rocky start.
So a constructive lesson from all of this would be what? Did you see anything in the EAA that did work?
I think it's really important to look at it very carefully and learn a variety of lessons, that there could be some good lessons and some bad lessons as well. But I would still argue that going forward, you know, there's some important lessons to learn about what not to do, whether it's the idea that you you know, craft this large scheme and try to implement it without step-by-step mechanisms to make sure what you're doing is really going to work in the schools, to make sure that your staff is prepared and trained to do the program that you're implementing, and that to have local buy-in and support for a program, it's just not very effective to use such a top-down and non-transparent governing system. And in effect, you could, you know, draw the same analogy to the EM policy.
Sarah, I want to circle back to the Detroit Education Commission. The plan to have a board that's able to approve school closings and openings is something that some charter advocates say stacks the deck against charters in favor of traditional public schools. Do you think that's true?
Well, if you look at the bill passed by the Senate, it explicitly states that three members of the board will be appointed from representatives from charters, from public school academies, including one parent. And then similarly, three from traditional public schools, and then one person who they say is sort of an expert on school accountability. So that suggests strong representation from mm-hmm. charter schools on this board. And frankly, in a lot of parts of the country, locally elected school boards are actually authorizers. So in Los Angeles, the locally elected school board authorizes all of the charter schools. So I would actually say Detroit specifically, but Michigan more generally, we are a bit unusual in how many organizations we have involved in these decisions.
What role, more generally, what role do you see charters playing in a new Detroit public education system?
Well, hopefully a constructive one. I mean, I think, you know, there's an opportunity here for a lot of these stakeholders, including charters, to start to see their role in Detroit as part of a Detroit educational community, and that these are all schools that serve Detroit children, and that it's not
that's
sort
not
of charter.
That's not there now?
No, I don't think so. I think very often the debate is framed as charter versus public schools, unfortunately. And frankly, if you look at a lot of other major urban districts around the country, charter schools are performing better than our schools here. And while the charters might, you know, often try to compare themselves to DPS schools, which we know have been hobbled financially for many years now, they should be upping their game. They can do better. And I hope that this puts pressure on them to really look more at accountability and excellence as charter schools.
Sarah Reckow is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State. We're talking about the shifting educational landscape of Detroit and what bills being debated in the state legislature would mean for the future of the city's public education system. We're also joined by Tanya Allen, president and CEO of the Skillman Foundation and director of the Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children. Tanya, to what extent does the success of a new district in Detroit depend on attracting students and families back to the city?
I think the success definitely depends on that, but I think the success of the district first depends on a high-quality educational experience. And I think ultimately the reason that the district has not been able to prevail is that it's not had steady leadership, which is not its own doing. It's been making decisions predominantly based on finances rather than academics. Again, not its doing. And then lastly, it does not have a strong academic plan that would convince parents and families that, yes, this is a place I want to fully entrust my children. I think that the district has not fully utilized its assets. It has lots of great things. Some of the best schools in the city of Detroit are Detroit Public Schools, both the traditional system and the charter schools. Yet they don't talk about that. They're not replicating those models in a way, and they're not engaging their teaching staff, which are really talented folks and who have been committed to this district, but are disgruntled, as I talked about before, for good reason. They haven't engaged them in really developing a plan in which they will address these challenges head on.
A final question for both of you. I'll start with you, Tanya. The plans in the House and Senate have been described by some as basically a $720 million Band-Aid. There are certainly lots of challenges ahead. What do you think will be the biggest obstacles facing a new DPS?
Well, I would say that the biggest obstacle facing a new DPS is believing that Lansing is fixing their problems. So this package does create what I call triage. It keeps the patient alive, and it's at this point that we have to really invest in the transition so that we can get to a transformation. And that transition is really hard work. It's the kind of work of engaging the community, engaging parents, engaging young people in their education, enlisting the teachers to redesign the curriculum and to name a few key priorities that we and indicators that we really want to move, and coordinating the community behind that so that we all have transparency on what those goals are and transparency on whether there's progress or not. So I think the biggest challenge for DPS is that we got to suspend the disbelief that it can get better, and we also are going to have to work really hard to do it.
Sarah Reckow, what do you think? Biggest obstacle facing a new DPS?
I think, yes, that trust is a very big issue across, whether it's across traditional public schools and charter schools. And then the biggest issue is, I think, as Tanya stated earlier, that this is really only the beginning, and that the hard work ahead is actually improving things academically for all of these schools. And that is going to require all hands on deck. It's going to require collaboration, and it's going to require persistence. It's not going to, you know, part of the issue with something like the EAA was this idea that you're going to, you know, suddenly see improvement in 2 years. And it's a very long road, and everyone has to be prepared for that and prepared to stay with it.
We've been talking about the future of the Detroit Public Schools and how bills being debated in the state legislature right now might play a role in shaping that future. Our guests have been Assistant Professor of Political Science at MSU, Sarah Reckow, and Tanya Allen, CEO of the Skillman Foundation and Director of the Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children. Sarah, Tanya, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And your feedback and suggestions are always welcome here on Current State. Email us, currentstate@wkar.org. Coming up, from continental droughts to failed city water systems, Charles Fishman's been studying and forecasting global water challenges for years. The author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water, talks to WKAR's Kirk Heinze, coming up on Current State. With Easter this weekend, the season for egg decorating is certainly here, but there can be much more than just a piece of plastic or fiddling with those cheap wire-dipping mechanisms. Current State's Jamie Paisley explored an excellent method. I hope you don't mind those puns, Jamie.
Mark, would it be public radio without puns?
No, it wouldn't.
No, you have to have it.
True enough.
I forgive you for making it. It's fine. But just at the beginning, as the beginning of Lent brings that Polish fried dough of punschki, the end of Lent brings another difficult-to-pronounce P word. Pysanki, or it involves some rather intricate patterns placed on eggs. But the mystery is, how does one get so many vibrant colors onto the shell of an egg? To find out, I met with Pat Krasinski.
The Polish way of saying is Krawczynski. And I am president of Polish Falcons of America, Nest 652, here in Lansing. And we are located at the Federated Polish Home.
At the corner of MLK and Mount Hope.
Correct. Yes.
A couple days ago, you had a class, essentially, and this is not the first class that you've had a certain event. What was happening at that event?
We had a pysanki making class. Pysanki is egg decorating. Actually, it's the word pysanki means writing on, and we don't really handwrite words on the eggs. We actually have symbols, and the different symbols mean different things, and so. We had a class where you could sign up and come in and learn how to do the art of pysanki making. We only could have the total of 15 because the lady that teaches it, she's very good, but she needs to take time with each person, because if it's your first time coming, it's a little difficult. But the second year gets better, and the third year is even better than that. And so she only allows us to have 15 in the class. Now next year, because it's been so popular this year, we're thinking about maybe doing it two times. But it's something that I'm going to have to discuss with our organization to see if we want to do that.
And part of the difficulty is there's a lot of intricate designs that you're making, and you don't want to you want to take your time with that as well. And part of that is the tool that's used, right, to apply. And when people came for the class, were there individual tools, or did they have to bring their own wax? I don't know what the term is, wax pen? What would it be?
Well, it's a kiosk. It's called a kiosk. It looks like a little funnel on the end of a stick or something. And you put wax in it, and then it drips down. You heat up the wax with a candle, and we use a candle. Each person has their own. Josefa supplies all of that. Our instructor supplies everything for us, including the eggs that have been blown out.
Typically, when people do, you know, their own regular dyeing of eggs, not Pisanki, but, you know, the traditional, what is the easiest way? It's just hard-boiled eggs. But as you say, blowed out, does that mean what I think it is, like the yolk is removed, correct?
Correct. Everything is removed from the inside. Now, Josefa does that for us, thank goodness. She usually does it the week before. And there is a tool that you can purchase that looks like it's got a needle on the end and an accordion suction cup. And it pokes the bottom of the egg, the widest part of the egg. You poke the metal part in there, and of course it's hollow inside. And you squeeze the accordion bubble, poke it in there, and then as you let go of that accordion thing, it sucks the inside of the egg out. Mm. Any traditional Pisanki, the egg is taken out of the inside of the shell.
Which makes it exceedingly delicate at that point.
Absolutely. And I learned that the hard way. And we have had people, you know, Josefa, God bless her, she'll bring extra eggs because 9 out of 10 times each class, there's at least one person that halfway through drops their egg and has to start all over again. So it's just inevitable. I mean, you know, it happens. Yes, that's a special tool.
And the advantage of that is that the Pisanki then lasts far longer than a hard-boiled.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this, like I said, this was our fifth year of doing it. And last year, I have a cabinet that I keep my eggs in for each year as they progress. And last year, I was cleaning my cabinet, and I dropped one of my eggs. I was so upset, but I made another one this year. It's okay. Mine, I said, I'm not giving it to anybody. You know, I'm just keeping it myself. And my grandchildren, I'm sure, will love it in years to come.
We're speaking with Pat Krasinski of the Federated Polish Home of Lansing about the very colorful, or rather color-filled method of egg decoration, which has ties to both Poland and Ukraine origins, called Pisanki. And Pat, I suppose now it's time to make an egg. So how does the Pisanki teacher, Josefa, go about that?
So what you do to begin with, she gives us a white egg that has been blown out, and she shows us how to mark the egg with a pencil. There's different ways to put different markings to make different things, to just kind of give you an idea on the egg where you want to put your designs and stuff. So that's the first step, using the pencil to mark your designs. Then you go, and you don't do everything. You just basically put on a map as to where you want to position stuff. Then the kiosk and the wax, you put a little wax in the kiosk, you warm it up with the candle, and then when you put it on the egg, it leaves a really fine wax line. She has three kinds of kiosks, a really thin one, a medium, and then a thicker kiosk.
And then as you move the kiosk, the wax then wicks away onto the egg surface.
Correct. So you have to keep putting a little bit of wax in the kiosk, you know, as you're working the egg. But surprisingly, it goes pretty far. I was amazed at that part. And you start out with the lighter color. You are using egg dyes. So you would put your design on. Let's say you wanted white on the design. Okay. So you take the kiosk with the wax in it. You cover everything that you want white, and then she puts it in the color that you want to do. And you always do light to dark, which usually people start, you know, with a yellow color they're going to do next, like yellow or green or, you know, something light color. And she'll dip it in that, and then you take it out, and then you go back, and whatever you want to keep yellow, you use the wax and paint on the yellow, whatever you want to do in yellow. And let's say I want to go to orange. So then she'll put it in the orange. The egg comes out orange. And then you go back, and it's a process. By the time you get done with the colors, the egg looks ugly because the wax turns black, you know, because of the soot in the candle and stuff. And but it looks terrible. And you're like, oh, this is going to be awful. But then after you're done putting all your colors on, you put your final color on, then you go back and you take the candle and you put the egg up as close as you can, but don't touch because you'll burn the shell. When the wax gets runny, you wipe it off with a paper towel. And oh, it's beautiful. The colors come out and it's shiny because of the wax. And you just keep turning the egg and melting the wax and wiping it off. And when you get done, you've got a beautiful, beautiful egg.
So, it's the ugly duckling in egg form.
Exactly, exactly. And they turn out beautiful. Everybody's, you know, it's amazing on what they do. The feeling that comes over you that you've accomplished something and it is so beautiful. And there's flaws, but I'm human, you know. And
it's still yours.
Exactly, exactly.
So let's see the Pisanki.
Okay, these ones over here are mine. My favorite color is purple, so you will notice purple is on all of my eggs. So each one has come out a little different. This was the one I did this year. And then here is Josefa's. Now, hers is professional. She has a lot of intricate stuff, the star. She has the chickens on there. She's been doing it for years and years. This one is my favorite. I call this the Polish star because in Poland years ago, they would take their paper, their colored paper, and save it all year. And then at Christmas time, they would make out of that paper a Polish star.
Are you all right if I take photos of these as
sure.
well? Pat, thank you again.
Oh, you're so welcome. And thank you for coming and letting me share this with you. The Polish community really enjoys doing things in the community to show our Polish heritage, and this is just a small way of us doing it.
You can see the examples of the Pisanki art that Pat Krasinski showed me at the Federated Polish Home of Lansing online at WKAR.org by clicking Arts and Culture under the News banner. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Coming up on Current State, some MSU students are thinking big and building small with the campus's first tiny house. We talked to Tiffany Pupa about the 6x18-foot Sparty's cabin being built inside the MSU Surplus Center. Ah, small is beautiful. That and more coming up after the break on Current State. Lansing blues singer Twyla Birdsong singing On Your Side in Studio S here earlier this year. Tomorrow on Live Music Friday, our guest is Benny Benak III. Mr. Benak's a trumpeter and singer out of New York City, and tomorrow night he's playing with Rodney Whitaker and several local singers in a Summer Solstice Jazz Festival sponsored program featuring male vocalists. That happens at the Robin Theater in Lansing. Benny Benak. Tomorrow on Live Music Friday. We hope you can be here. Charles Fishman is a former reporter for the Washington Post, Orlando Sentinel, and Raleigh, North Carolina's News and Observer. For years, he has written about important water issues. He's the author of the book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Since its publication, the U.S. has undergone multiple major droughts and drinking water crises in places like Toledo, Ohio, and Flint. Charles Fishman recently checked in with WKAR's Dr. Kirk Heinze. Fishman's been a guest on Heinze's MSU Today segment, The Greening of the Great Lakes, before.
It's been kind of a wild 4 years since I was last on in the world of water. Well, Charles, when you wrote the book, The Big Thirst, you knew water was going to be a huge issue, was and would be. Did you have any idea, though, about how big this has gotten?
Since the book came out, California has been in drought the entire time. And that's kind of extraordinary. The longest, deepest drought in settled history in California. And, of course, we've got, for three of those 4 years, Texas was in drought. Those two states alone produce, you know, most of the agricultural products in the country. And Toledo, a couple years ago, having to turn its water supply from the Great Lakes off because it was contaminated with toxins. And, of course, now we've got a terrible man-made disaster in Flint that's related to the water system. There's been a whole series of lessons that we've had in the last 4 years about the need to take our water system seriously.
Well, yeah, and let's take the one that's most in the news around here, and you mentioned it, this crisis in Flint with the lead contamination of the drinking water. There's a lot of finger-pointing and a lot of politicizing of this event, but Charles, based on your knowledge of water and water resource management, what are the lessons that we can learn from this debacle in Flint?
The first thing to say about Flint is this was a disaster, literally a the water supply for a city of 100,000 people that was poisoned, that was completely avoidable. There was nothing inevitable about this. In fact, officials in the city of Flint's water system and in the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality knew well what to do, even if you wanted to switch from Detroit water, which was safe and in good shape, to Flint River water. There were things you needed to do, and the work had been done in advance of the switch. And so the fact that that water ended up corrosive and contaminated was literally a failure of water system officials and people whose job it was to protect the water system and protect the public. And so that lesson one is you need to take your responsibilities seriously, and we need to hold people accountable for their responsibilities. As an aside, in the world of water, this isn't very common. In fact, water people are very quiet. They're typically behind the scenes, but almost without exception, water systems are very well run in the country. They don't get much credit for being well run. And that makes what happened in Flint all the more important to understand. The second thing is all the problems could have been avoided in Flint, even with switching to the less appealing water, if the water system had added anti-corrosive agents, literally just phosphorus, the kind of stuff that's used in all kinds of chemical applications, including fertilizer. That's an anti-corrosive that's added to the water supply in hundreds of cities in the United States, thousands of cities worldwide, totally standard. Here's what it would have cost in Flint, $64 a day. And they knew. They had documents telling them to add that. And then the water would not have become corrosive. But the most important lesson from Flint is the water system across the country is not in great shape. It's D-minus, according to the American Society of Civil Engineering. That's the grade our water system nationwide gets, D-minus. Now, you may grump about your 4 LTE cell phone service, but no one's given it a D-minus. And so water systems need some attention. Often it's nothing more than the equivalent of $80 a day, but we grump and grouse about our water bills increasing. But the truth is most of us are living on water systems that were installed 50 or 80 or 100 years ago. And that engineering was brilliant, but it's 50 or 80 or 100 years old. And that is absolutely the case in Flint.
Yeah, you anticipated what I was thinking. In terms of that D-minus grade, how much of that is related to the aging infrastructure? Because you mentioned earlier that people do a pretty good job behind the scenes of making sure that our water is safe to drink. But, boy, cities like Flint, the infrastructure is so old I mean, that really conduced to the problem as much as anything.
It certainly made the problem worse. The D minus is almost exclusively, in fact, about age. Water systems don't need some kind of brilliant Manhattan Project. It's not the race to the moon. It's not even Silicon Valley. They need to be well-maintained. They need to be well taken care of. Look, the pipe replacement rate, the water main replacement rate in the United States is pathetic. In Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, where I live, the water utility is on a 150-year water pipe replacement cycle. So there are literally pipes in the ground that are 50 or 60 years old that may be in the ground until 2105. It's just ridiculous that we have cities in America where the water pipe replacement cycle is 150 years. The pipes aren't designed to last that long. We wouldn't drink out of a mug that was 150 years old. We wouldn't want to use a toilet or a water spigot that was 150 years old. We're not using telephones, in case anybody's noticed, that are 150 years old. And so the water infrastructure needs the kind of attention that in part it doesn't get because it works so well and because it's invisible. And that, you know, in Flint, there are many terrible ironies and little eddies in the Flint story that just make you shake your head. But one of them is that early on, residents complained about the quality of the water. It was muddy. It looked like badly made iced tea or badly made lemonade. And the water official said, well, there are no federal standards for the appearance of drinking water. We promise you it's safe. Here's a clue, ladies and gentlemen, which the residents of Flint don't need to be told. If your tap water looks like badly made iced tea, there's something seriously wrong. It's not, even though there are no standards for clarity, that's not what U.S. tap water should look like.
Charles, we've got a couple minutes left here, but let's switch here from the United States. The last time we talked, you were living in Mexico City. You had some challenges there. I've traveled to countries like Nepal and other third world countries where the water situation, frankly, is rather abominable. How does the progress we make in a country or in the developing world, how does that translate into progress in the developed world, translate into progress in the developing countries?
You know, we lived in Mexico City for 2 years, and no one in Mexico City drinks the tap water. Mexico City is a city of 21 million people, so there's more people in Mexico City than in the entire state of Michigan. In fact, there's twice as many people in Mexico City as in the entire state of Michigan. No one drinks the tap water, not people who are well off, and even the poorest people can afford bottled water and give bottled water to their children. So there's a great municipal water system, and everybody actually has access to tap water, and no one uses the tap water because the sewage pipes and the water supply pipes run right near each other. They're poorly maintained, and the sewer pipes leak into the water supply pipes. And so the clean water leaves the water treatment plant in Mexico City clean, and between the plant and your home or your business or your restaurant, the water gets contaminated by leaky sewage pipes. So you have this vast city, literally twice as many people as all of Michigan, and every day, all day long, there are men out on the streets moving water in bottles. The big 5-gallon bottles, you know, the old Culligan man bottles, little water bottles, enormous human effort to bridge a system that isn't working right. That's what happens when you don't take care of your water system. Now, actually, so we actually lived for 2 years without being able to brush our teeth with tap water. There was a pitcher of clean water in every bathroom that we refilled, you know, twice a day. You couldn't wash your strawberries or your cucumber or your lettuce in the tap water. You had to wash it in bottled water, and you actually had to soak it in anti-contamination and sterilization stuff. But again, you have to take care of the system you've got. And that may not seem like the sexiest thing in the world until you see what happens, you know, when you don't take care of it, and until you see grown men who spend their whole careers moving water around, which seems like, you know, it's essential, but it's also a tremendous waste of human effort and creativity.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Imagine trading in your three-bedroom, two-bathroom house for less than 400 square feet of living space. The rising popularity of tiny houses means that more Americans are doing just that. Current state producer April Van Buren learned about a project to build a tiny house right here on MSU's campus, and she joins me now to tell us more. So, April, what do you think is behind the popularity of tiny houses?
You know, Mark, I think Portlandia might be able to explain this a little bit better than I can.
Hi, welcome to Tiny Town.
Micro village.
Little place. And that's a tiny micro house.
Yeah, it's very, very efficient.
Everything is thought out. No waste of space anywhere. This is a bathroom and a home office.
Can you hand me the shower gel, please?
Yes, coming up.
You know what? Actually, that doesn't make it sound that appealing. But it isn't just Portland hipsters who are adopting the tiny house lifestyle. I talked to the student who spearheaded MSU's first tiny house project about why she thinks small living is gaining such a following in America. But first, let's head to the MSU Surplus Center for a tour of what will soon become Sparty's Cabin.
We're going to have a full porch on the front, so two people can hang out with their cup of coffee. And then our door is centered right in the middle. So you'll walk in, and we have this really large great room. That's where it's going to be your living room, your dining room, whatever you need it to be that day. Then in the back corner, we have the kitchen. It has an L-shaped countertop. It's very spacious. And then in this back left corner is the bathroom. So it has a shower and the composting toilet. Above the bathroom and the kitchen, we have our loft, which is, I think it's about 80 square feet. So it can have a queen-size bed. And we have a lot of windows in the space. So I think we have, you know, at least 5-6 on the first floor, some on the top, and then even the loft has its own windowed area. And then there's also a storage loft on the front side. It'll have a lot of natural light. We're gonna paint, you know, the inside white to let that light bounce around, make it seem bigger. And we really want the person inside to be able to connect with the outdoors. So just having these views to nature.
Always watch your fingers.
My name is Tiffany Pupa, and I'm a senior interior design student at Michigan State University. And the tiny house project is how I'm wrapping up my senior year, going out with a bang.
So this is kind of your last hurrah as a senior. Tell me a little bit about where this idea came from.
I'm in a student group called USGBC Students. That's United States Green Building Council, so we're just a student chapter. But every year, the chapters in the region get together, and we spend the day learning about sustainable topics. And there's one group that toured a tiny house, and it was very well received and very interesting. So when we were driving back from Cincinnati to Lansing, I was thinking about it, and I just couldn't stop. There was something about it that really stuck with me. And then I was thinking how we're from the School of Planning, Design, and Construction, and we could totally pull it off. We could build one of these things. So I emailed Dr. Crawford, the associate director of SPDC, that night, and it turned out she had just started working on a tiny house project with some other students, just kind of exploring how that would work in a community. She said, this is a wonderful idea, let's do some research. So from that moment on, I started researching just about how can you build one of these things, and how can you get this many people, so you have about 200 students working on this, to interact with the house and have a meaningful experience with it.
And so tell me a little bit about the design process when you're planning what this tiny house is going to look like. What did you want to include? What did you want it to look like?
Well, we went to a three-day workshop, so there was a group of four students that went, and there we learned just some basic design things like, you know, symmetry, what do you want it to look like, color schemes. That was just a small portion of it, and then we learned really what are the restraints. These are the things that we didn't know before. So we learned about the weight limits. So some people like to see reclaimed wood on their tiny houses, the outside, and it looks really beautiful, but it weighs a lot. And if your trailer weighs too much, then your truck won't be able to pull it. You'll have to get a bigger truck. So we wanted to avoid that. And then also, you know, this house is going to be moving. It's inevitable. You know, even if we're just getting it to the site of whoever eventually owns it, it has to be able to withstand the different, you know, forces that will be on it, on the highway. And it needs to be able to have some flex and give. So we weren't allowed to use things such as tile or things that could kind of come apart through moving. So that brought us down to, like, what's really going to be reasonable and rational to use in this house. And we're partnering with MSU Shadows Collection. It's a student group. So normally on campus when there's construction, these trees would be burned or chipped to mulch. But this group goes in and they salvage these trees, turn them into lumber, and then they use that to create a product, whether that's a cutting board or a wine stopper, table, etc. So they're doing our countertops, our ladder, and our shelves.
And so was that an important part of this house, was including sort of sustainable reused materials?
Yes, yes it was. So other sustainable products that we're using cellulose insulation as opposed to a foam or other solution that would possibly leach VOCs or toxins into the air. We're having a compost toilet. And everywhere we can, we're choosing our materials based off of the sustainability.
I'm talking to Tiffany Pupa. She's a senior interior design student in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at MSU. We're talking about the tiny house project that she conceptualized and is working on for kind of her last hurrah as a senior. How did you first get interested in sustainable design?
I've always been interested in sustainability and design. My mom is an interior designer and a homemaker, and she's also very frugal. So we're always been, you know, creating projects at home and reusing whatever we can. That's where my introduction to sustainability began. Then in high school, I was in AP Environmental Science, and I was thinking that I wanted to be a environmental engineer, you know, maybe work for the EPA, and that's where my mind was. But I always had this love of art, and so my teacher gave me a project to design a home to be as sustainable as possible. And it was a small assignment. It was really supposed to just take a day to do research, but I took a lot more time than that, and I got really into it. And I remember being mind blown. About that carpeting. I couldn't believe that carpet, some of them can have released VOCs, and I couldn't believe that we're gluing down this carpet with adhesives that have formaldehyde and all these toxins in them. And then I found out that carpet could potentially even clean the air that we're in. And I just started wondering, how does this impact, especially in healthcare? So that was my first kind of connection between design and sustainability. On a human level, and from that, I just got obsessed, switched my major, decided to go to MSU, and I took off from there.
And one of the really cool parts of the project, other than, you know, the tiny house itself, which is pretty cool, is what's going to happen after it's finished. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So when it's completely finished, and once we have used it to educate the community and, you know, maximize our use with it, we're going to auction the home through surplus. And once, you know, that process is finished, we're going to take those proceeds, maintain a seed fund for the students to be able to do projects like this again in the future, and then we'll donate the rest of the funds to charity. We have not identified one quite yet, but we're looking at something revolving around housing, whether that's homelessness or abused women and children's centers that provide housing for people who need it immediately and who need a safe home.
What do you think it is? I mean, I think tiny houses have sort of captured people's imaginations recently. I think House Hunters even has a House Hunters tiny house now, a tiny house edition now on HGTV. What do you think it is about tiny houses that are having a moment right now?
I think it can speak to a lot of what people want. So the tiny house is a really supportive element to a minimalist lifestyle. There's something about going out and capturing your adventure and living off of experiences rather than materials. So I think it really captures people who are looking for things like that. But then also I've noticed that it's very popular with the millennial generation. Having something to own but still being able to work in a community. So a lot of times tiny houses will kind of form a community, and maybe they'll have, you know, shared use facilities that they all use, or such as gardens or a pool or a gym or whatever that may be. Then it's also attractive to other generations, for those who want to, you know, downsize, a lot of retirees, or even parents who want to move closer to their children after they moved out. They're finding that this is a really great way to support that.
Tiffany Puba is a senior in interior design in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at MSU. We've been talking about the tiny house that they are building in the MSU Surplus Center right now. Tiffany, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you very much for letting me talk about our project.
And that's our show for Thursday. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, trumpeter-singer Benny Benack III is our Live Music Friday guest. On Friday night, he'll perform at a program sponsored by the Summer Solstice Jazz Festival, featuring several other male vocalists and Rodney Whitaker from the MSU Jazz Studies program. The show will be at Lansing's Robin Theater, but you'll hear Benny Benack III live tomorrow morning. Also, a reminder, the pop-up stories is tonight. That's it. The Broad Art Museum. We hope to see you there between 6 and 7:30. Grab some cookies and punch and listen to a fantastic lineup of storytellers talk about their lucky breaks. We hope to see you there, and we thank you for being here. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.